At this time in the retreat, I wanted to cover the subject of insight and how it works, what it is, how it's developed, or rather how it arises. I made a great deal of emphasis on this retreat, once again, on the truth of the process rather than a will, that these deep states of meditation, they happen when you get out of the way, rather than there's something which you do and will and bring into existence through choice or desire. And the same is true of insight as well. Sometimes the people think, just in the same way that they wrongly think that they should be doing jhanas, they should be making a nimitta appear, they also have the delusion of thinking that they must make insight arise, that they must do something to get insight to happen. They must look and search and grab onto insight, the same way that you go out searching for material goods in the shops, in the markets, in the shopping malls. But insight is of a completely different nature. The same with these jhanas, are a completely different nature. They come from going against the stream, not by going with the stream. They're not of this world, in the sense that you go off to a university to do a good degree and you learn all the facts about engineering or computing or whatever. The insight is of a completely different nature. It comes always from silence. It comes from going against the stream, going inwards to the source of things. And it so often comes, in fact it always comes, when you're least expecting it. Because when you're searching, you're not looking. When you're trying to grasp, you're not letting go. So you're going in the wrong direction. You never see the source of things when you're looking out there into the world, thinking that wisdom is somewhere out there, somewhere in the next moment, somewhere in the next experience, when never actually sees it, when it really is here. So this is actually what we mean by insight, seeing into the centre of things, seeing in to the heart of things, the source of things. You've heard me say already that the cause of insight is called samadhi. And that's straight from the Buddha's suttas. It comes up again and again and again. And the samadhi which the suttas, the Buddha is talking about, is always samma samadhi in that context, which is the jhanas, which is a great stillness of the mind and a great openness of the mind. The mind which has gone against the stream so much, it's gone very close to the source of things. At least it's gone into the mind anyway. And that's pretty much close to the source. So it's gone so deep. And then as a result of that, in many suttas, in one in particular, the Buddha stated that a person who experiences samadhi, those jhanas, they do not need to make the resolution. They do not need to think. They do not need to decide. In the, we use the word chaitati, they do not need to will. Oh, may I see things as they truly are. Oh, that wisdom, insight may arise. It happens as a natural course, that for one who has samadhi, they see things as it truly is. And I mention that point and stress that point because it shows just the automatic part of this process. It's not as if you do samadhi and then you do insight. You don't do anything. You're just this great passenger on this journey. This person who just sits down there silently and just watch all of these things unfolding. Effort happens. Will appears. But you realize it's not coming from you. It's all part of this process. And this whole process leads you into samadhi, and then from samadhi into insight, from insight into enlightenment, freedom, liberation, end of samsara. This beautiful natural process which just unfolds and you're just a passenger on a journey. So that when people ask, well, once you've got samadhi, what do you do next? Should you contemplate sort of the four foundations of mindfulness, or you should reflect on what just happened, or should you contemplate the Four Noble Truths, or should you read your suttas? What should I do? They keep on asking, and it's a stupid question. So you don't have to decide to do anything. What will happen, happens. The natural process starts. And you're just a passenger. You think you might be doing it, but you're not. It's just part of the process of insight unfolding. So what happens? It's not what you do. What happens is what I'm talking about here. You don't do this, it's just what occurs. It's not under your power to do or not to do this. What happens when you get into such deep states of stillness is that this doer business stops. And when you come out of these states of samadhi, this doer, this controller, this wanter, this grasper, remains quite still for long periods of time afterwards. Which is why that when we get into deep states of meditation, we can't do anything, we can't move sometimes. Even when you're walking, you just can't go any further, you can't come out. I remember when I was a young monk in Thailand doing walking meditation, and I would get so still in that walking meditation, I'd forget all time, and I'd forget everything around me. This was in the middle of Bangkok. I remember once walking outside by the main hall, and this monk came up to me. And for those of you who know what meditation is like when you get very, very still, they come up right next to you, but it's as if they're 100 miles away. They speak directly into your ear, but you can only just hear it. It's just like the sound more distant than the traffic on the road outside. You hear it as such a far distant sound, just grabbing your attention, and your attention is grabbed so reluctantly. This monk came to tell me that I was late for Dharma. I'd forgotten all about it. I didn't know at that moment. I was just too happy doing my meditation. And he'd been sent to come and fetch me. So I remember that time just having to come out so reluctantly from samadhi. And it was actually, even though I knew I had a duty to perform, he was much senior to me, I was only a newly ordained monk, and I had to go to that dharma. I remember just gazing down 2 meters in front of me, and with all the effort which I could muster, turning my head. And it took me just about 2 or 3 minutes actually to turn my head up to him. I'm going very fast, much faster than I did at the time. And just looking at him and just saying, pardon? And that's actually what happens. And I think many of you can understand, appreciate, that's just what it's like in samadhi. And sometimes you might be sitting meditation and the bell rings for the chanting or for breakfast. And again you hear it, but there's such a great distance. You can't come out. If you do come out, it's such a struggle to come out. It takes you such a long time to come out. That's as it should be. That's wonderful when that happens. That just shows how still you've become. And how the mind, just even if it should be moving, just cannot move. That's the degree of stillness and stability which is necessary for contemplation. Because so you've seen that simile which I've given before, the gong bonger. You hold it up and what is that? It's amazing that when our mind is not still, we have all these thoughts in our mind. Sometimes it's not even looking at the gong bong, it's thinking, what does he mean by that? What's the right answer? What's the wrong answer? What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to answer? All those thoughts which come in the mind stop you from actually seeing what the gong bong is. But you find that if you have stillness, you can take up any object, the most ordinary objects, put them in front of your vision, and it just stays there. It stays there for a long period of time, long enough for you to really get to understand what it truly is, at least to get much closer. So much of our life is superficial. We rush from one object to the next, from one place to the next, sometimes from one retreat to the next, without really slowing down and stopping. Already it's Friday, it's one more day left. But have you left yet? Have you already left and already planning what you're going to do next, tomorrow when we have to leave? Sometimes, that we're running so fast through life, we're always on the next appointment. We're always on the next plane, the next stage of the journey. And that's why we're rushing so fast from terminal to terminal of our life, that we never have enough stillness to see really the scenery around us. To never really understand where we are. What is this thing we call life? When you get very, very still, you have the opportunity to take up simple things and for once really see them and really understand them. Wisdom, insight takes time. Very often, either we haven't got the time, we don't give the time, or more likely, we're unable to give the time because of restlessness. Because of restlessness, we can't just stay with an object in order to understand it fully. That's why, because we're running off to the next object. Our knowledge of life is just so superficial. We may take this body, we may take this mind, we may take the doer, the consciousness, the universe or whatever. We never understand it until we really still with it and allow it to open up to us, to teach us. There's been many similes for the arising of insight which I've given on this retreat so far. The simile of the carpet was one of them. The simile of the leaves outside. When you just look at a leaf and it's just so green and so beautiful, you're so still with it, you have a chance to understand it. Or like that hillside going up to my monastery. When one is still, one sees. One sees things one never knew were there. Unexpected things. Details which are hidden from the consciousness which moves too fast. And not only is it delightful, not only is it really inspiring, it brings you huge amounts of joy, you understand why it is that people are deluded. Why it is they can't see fully. Simply because they are moving too fast. That's why the idea of like a kanika samadhi, a momentary samadhi, it just doesn't make sense at all. It's what in Australian slang we call a furphy. It's not a real thing. It can't be a real thing. Samadhi is that stillness. You feel that stillness. You know that stillness. After a while of meditation, you can take up anything. And just hold it. It's the greatest of ease. You start with the breath. You go to beautiful breath. You go to nimittas. You go into jhana, so you just stay there, effortlessly. That's how you get to know them. When the mind doesn't move, you have all the time to get information. That's where you gain the data for insight. Usually what happens, one of the other reasons, another simile which I like to bring up to show just how, when the mind is moving, when there's too much going on, or we can't get insight, is one of Ajahn Chah's similes. In our monasteries in the northeast of Thailand, and many of you have been there now, to those forest monasteries, maybe they'd be far more developed than when I used to live in them. But even so, they still have the paths through the jungle, the swept paths which the monks usually sweep every day. And they sweep those paths for very good reason, so you can see any snakes or other animals who cross those paths, who are danger to your very life. So we sweep those paths every day. As you were sweeping those paths, the earth underneath was a very fine white sand. It was very poor soil for actually growing crops, but great soil for rainforest. So that soil was like a white sand. So after you'd swept the leaves, it was as if there were rivers of white going through this green, dark, dusty jungle in the forest monasteries. And because the sand was so white, and because it reflected any rays from the sun which penetrated the leaves of the jungle foliage, it really shone. It was almost like translucent white, those sands, those paths. And so when a leaf fell down from the trees, as a young monk, as soon as one leaf fell down, you turn around and sweep it off because it marred the perfection of the path. You know how your perfection is when you're young. After a while, you get sort of fed up with doing that. You turn around and sweep one leaf, then you turn around and another leaf drops. It's just an endless task. So you do the good enough practice. It's good enough. You don't try and make it perfect because perfection is impossible. Leaves are falling all the time. You need 100 hands and 100 brooms to be able to keep it clean all the time. But Ajahn Chah said, when that first leaf falls on the swept jungle path, it really stands out. You see it so clearly. You see its shape, its colour, and the way it's positioned. But if the leaf falls, not on the path, but in the jungle, you can hardly notice it, because it's swamped by so many other leaves. There's too much confusion on the jungle floor. But on the newly swept path, the leaf, the first leaf which falls, is very easy to see and to understand and find its meaning. The same way Ajahn Chah said, when you swept the mind free from all restlessness, from all thoughts, from all extraneous objects which cloud the meditation object itself, when you're that still and free from clutter, when the first thing falls onto that clean path of your mind, it really stands out so clearly, so profoundly, you can see it maybe for the first time. But when it falls in amongst so many other things, it's so hard to understand. Which is why in meditation, when the mind is very still, one thing which falls into the mind can so easily be contemplated, because you're not confused, you're not distracted by anything else except that one gong bonger, or that one thing, whichever else it is. So still, are we still okay? Okay, still okay. So this is actually what happens with the arising of insight. You don't make a choice, it just happens by itself. And sometimes we wonder why it is that that insight happens all by itself. Why it is that we actually, some people say get into jhana, get into meditation, and they gain insights which relieve one from suffering, which gain streamlining and so forth, while other people, maybe of other traditions, don't. I've already mentioned the importance of right view, the map. But the point is here that that right view, that map, cannot come from you, because you've never been to that territory before. The maps are written by others who've been there before you. Which is why in the suttas, the teachings of the Buddha, they say there's two causal factors which give rise to the insights, the deep insights, the stream winning. I'm not talking about the ordinary insights here. I'm talking about the big ones. Ordinary insights are fun. Ordinary insights sometimes delightful and blow the mind. When you have the insight into the nature of a carpet, that's great fun. Or the insight into the nature of concrete, when that opens up to you, that's enormous bliss, but it never gets you enlightened. That just shows you what insight is capable of, but it's not applied to the right areas. To become enlightened, you've got to apply that insight to certain areas of existence. It's applied insight. And how do you apply that insight? The point is, you don't apply it at all. Other people tell you where to apply it. What I'm saying here is the two causes for the rise of the stream winner. The right view of the stream winner is work of the mind which goes back to the source, number one, which I've already mentioned, yoniso manasikara. Yoniso means to the womb or of the womb, and manasikara literally work of the mind, of the manas. It's going against the stream, as I've been mentioning all this retreat. Not going with craving, going against craving, going to the source of things, going inwards, inwards, into the carpet, into the leaf, into the mind, into the gong bonger. For that you need that silence for long periods of time. But the other cause for the rising of insight is called paratogosa, the words of another. What we mean here, what the Buddha is meaning, and what's made very clear in other suttas, is it's the instructions from the Arians, from the noble ones, for those who've seen the Dhamma, the stream winners, those who attained the stream winners and above. From those people's words, you get the programming, the instructions on where to watch, on how to watch. You cannot do it by yourself. And the reason being is that the way of delusion is this psychic process, which I mentioned a few days ago, of the perception, making thoughts, making views, bending perception. This is the way our mind works. I'll mention it again because this is important for the understanding of why insight doesn't happen, or rather what is wrong insight. Sometimes we take bare perceptions to be true. I heard this, I saw it, I felt it, it must be true. Those bare perceptions, after a while you see, are also unreliable. What we perceive is not necessarily what happened. The reason is, because number one, we filter. those things which aren't useful to us, which aren't important to us, you don't even pay any attention to at all. But those things which we think are important, which are meaningful to us, those things we take on board. And in fact, we filter according to our defilements. We filter to see what we want to see, what fits our worldview, what fits our understanding, what we like to hear. And we can't see what challenges us, what causes fear. We can't see what we don't like to see. Any psychologist knows that, but a meditator just knows that what the psychologist knows is just the tip of an iceberg. It goes so much more deeper than that, so much more powerful. It's very hard to see what is frightening. It's very hard to see what challenges our attachments. It's very hard to see what challenges our idea of self, of what we are, and who we, and what we own. I've already tested that out a few times by giving little talks on non-self, especially on will and the knower. I don't expect anybody to agree with that. It's a nature not to agree with that. It's a nature to challenge that. That can't be true. That can't be right. That's the way things are. But the reason I say that is because that's truth. And by suggesting that, I'm giving enough power to Gosa, enough words of another, so that when you are still, when there is so much peace in the mind, that you can become courageous. You can actually creep up on this thing we call self and see it. Without the words and suggestions of another, you would not be able to do this. What actually happens is we look. We look especially at the four places where most people take themselves to be. You know those four places through the four Satipatthanas. Why are there four Satipatthanas? Not five, not three. Because the Buddha in his great wisdom saw that human beings usually hold on to one of those four as being themselves. This is what the self is made of. Body, feelings, pleasure and pain business. The mind, the knower, or the doer, part of the sankhara, the Dhamma, the source of all this doing business. When you actually remember those four Satipatthanas, which you hear them again and again and again, when you hear them for months, and what happens after a deep meditation? Naturally, you look at each one of these, and you see that this body is not me, it's not mine, does not belong to me. Sometimes we think that we already know that. This body is not me, not mine or self. It might be so obvious you may have had the good fortune to have gone to autopsies and seen bodies being cut apart. You may have the good fortune to have seen a death of a loved one and to have seen them alive and been with them in the process when they take their last breath and go cold. Those experiences help, but they're not good enough. Because sometimes, even though we may have been with death so often, still, it doesn't go deep enough to us. Because there's something inside which rejects that truth. Even though it should be so obvious, when you see death, when you feel death, especially with someone you've lived with so many years, sometimes it still doesn't sink in. But as them, so me. Which is why, or which is one of the examples of why truth, even though it's so obvious, doesn't sink in, simply because it challenges our basic beliefs of our self-existence. Which is why that we need the depth of a jhana, the power of those jhana-produced mindfulnesses, and the stillness to be able to see it fully. The test, obviously, is when you do get sick. So sick that you could die. Why are people afraid of death? Why is it if, say, a snake comes into this hall that we're afraid? When if we just sit still, it wouldn't strike us at all. Snakes actually go for the people who are most afraid, because they run and they make the snake afraid. It doesn't make any sense being afraid in the face of snakes. It just makes it more likely you're going to be struck and killed. But why is it we're afraid of these things? What are we afraid of? What's the worst thing that could happen to us? Only that we die. So what? Big deal. Isn't it better to die of snake bite than to die of a lingering cancer? Or dementia in an old people's home for a long period of time? Is that how you like to die? So when a snake comes, oh goody. So why is it that we're afraid of these things? Why is it that when, you know, you get a cancer, you get scared shit about dying? Why? These are the times when it really comes close to us that on the surface we may think, yes, I'm not attached to my body. I know that this is going to die. See everyone else dying, I'm going to die. I've been to so many funerals, touched death. But it's still only superficial. It hasn't gone to the bones of you, to the heart of you. It hasn't gone to the source. That's why the Buddha even said, for everybody, when you get deep meditation, then to contemplate the body. Then you can actually see it. And you actually can go past these obstacles, these blind spots, where you're still attached, you still cling to this thing we call a body. You've already found in this process of meditation, this is such an easy way to get into jhanas. I've been telling you all this last week. How many of you have done it? You know why you haven't? It's called attachment to your body. That's why you haven't got jhanas. That is the basic obstacle to attaining jhanas. It's fascinating, it's crazy. But you don't see that. That's why we do this practice. Moving further and further, you come across an obstacle, let it go. Come across an obstacle, let it go. Finding out these attachments. Why is it attachment to the body the main obstacle? Because the body is the five senses. The five senses are the body. They go together so much. When the five senses die, so does the body. When the body dies, so does the five senses. Sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch. Why is it one can't let go of touch? Let the body disappear. What is thinking anyway? Thinking about the five sense world. What you're going to do next? Where are you going to go? Where's your body going to go? What body going to eat? What's it going to... Sexual fantasies, what's the body going to enjoy? All these things have all to do with the body. Sometimes those thoughts are like echoes of the five senses. Old sights, old sounds. Manufacturing them, making them, playing with them. All five senses. Because we can't let go of this body in this five sense world and all the play of the world, that's why we can't allow our mind just to let go and go into jhanas. Because that's what jhanas are. What happens when you let go of the body in the five senses? When the five senses stop and the body is just abandoned, you don't care about it, it's sitting there, whatever happens to it, no, don't give a damn. Then the mind goes into these beautiful, peaceful states. It's still states of jhana. That's what that first jhana is. Vivicheva kamehi. Separated from the world of the five senses. Remember the three worlds I said last night? Kama loka, the world of the five senses, the world of the bodies. Rupa loka, arupa loka, the world of jhanas and the immaterial attainments. If you let go of kama loka, vivicheva kamehi. Detached, aloof, separated from the world of karma, of the five senses. That means you're away from that world. You've let it go. You know you can let it go, because you have let it go. You know that you have untied those attachments. That's the test, whether you're attached to the body or not, whether you get into jhanas. Why not get into jhanas? It's so blissful, it's so lovely, it's so wonderful and peaceful, there's no danger at all. It's, why up? Because you're attached to the body. Sometimes people think we'll die. The breath has stopped. Ah! Sometimes we think the sort of you know, we're getting into this state where you can't say anything and think anything, everything's going to go wrong. I'm going to lose my mind. I'm going to lose everything. It's great to lose everything. The more you can lose, the better. Be a loser. Thinking about going against the stream in the world. All great monks are losers. The Buddha was the biggest loser in the world. He lost the whole of samsara, his mind, everything. So what we're doing here is testing what attachment to the body is. That's why the Buddha said to do the body awareness. See, this has nothing to do with me. Get born and die, might as well die now. If you could die this moment, quite happily, you can die from this body, from the five senses, and go into jhanas. What happens when you die? You see the nimitta, you go towards the nimitta, the same thing. It's all dying, letting go of the body, putting down the body. That's why many monks, nuns, do body contemplation to prepare themselves for jhanas, so they can open up and get into the samasamadhi. And afterwards they realize, yeah, of course it's obvious, this body has nothing to do with it. I've had so many bodies. The mind is not the body, the mind is completely different. And this body thing is just a waste of time, basically. You feed it, you put all this breakfast and lunch in it, and what happens to it? It all goes down the toilet afterwards. Everything you eat is shit. It is, but it's in there, isn't it? You don't get that from anywhere else. That's in the food you eat. It's right in there. And some other stuff gets absorbed by the body. And what's left, which is most of it, comes out the other end. So when you're having lunch, have a look, in whatever you're eating there, there must be shit in there somewhere. That's the same with human beings, isn't it? They're full of it. It's right there, right now. That's why I keep on telling, if you sort of have a relationship with someone, don't squeeze your partner too hard. This monk's being gross. It's only monks that say things like this. It's good fun. So, when you actually see that body, you know, it's what it is, you can let it go. And you get into jhanas. Means you're not going to pick up another body after this death. Why do people get reborn in the Karmaloka? Because they want to get attached to a body again and identify with it. Think it's so important. As soon as this one goes, they're going to pick up another one. Have you had enough yet? Have you had enough of headaches and gut aches and ear aches and whatever other aches you have? When you get a body, this is what comes with it. Toothaches and everything else. So when actually you see the body for what it is, you become detached from it. The insight into the body is not me, not mine, not a self. Nothing to do with me. So whatever happens to you, if you get skin cancer, if you get sort of ugly, if you get smelly, it doesn't matter, it's just your body, that's all. Forget it. That's the first place where the self hangs out in the body. And don't think that you've overcome that just because you understand life and death and you think you're ready to die. So many people, even monks, and nuns, so-called good monks and nuns, they come to the last few moments and they get afraid. They didn't realize they were attached to their body after all. It's very difficult. This is called delusion. Delusion is what we can't see. The blind spot. The blind spots in our vision. We think we're okay, but it's only when we get tested. I've been testing you all week. Can you get to jhana or not? Why not? Attachment to body. The other great attachment is pleasure and pain. Do you like pleasure? Afraid of pain? Why is it you're trying to get into jhanas? For the sake of pleasure? I've been using that as a bit of a trick. But the more you want it, the harder it gets. If you're attached to pleasure, and you grasp it, you'll never get the pleasures of jhanas. You won't even get the pleasures of nimittas. But what happens? As soon as we let go, as soon as we relax, we don't grasp at all. Pleasure, pain, it's all the same. Pleasure is just the gap between two moments of pain. Pain is just the gap between two moments of pleasure. You get jhanas, you have to come out of jhanas. That's the way it is. go in again and come out again. That's all what life is. So this is, you don't attach. This is just the nature of things when you let go. This is what happens. You don't go grasping for it or desiring it or craving it. You cannot crave and achieve jhanas. You let go craving. That's how these things are achieved. So you're also testing to see how much you attach to pleasure and pain, to joy and other things. See whether you can truly let them go. So that's the second satipatthana. What actually is sort of the beauty and happiness? See a beautiful sunset. Why is it beautiful? What's going on there? When you hear a delightful discourse, why is it delightful and what last week wasn't? It's just pleasure and pain associated with samsara. If you're attaching to that, again, you'll never be still. You'll always be searching for the next good Dhamma talk. You'll always be searching for the next bit of inspiration. You'll always be searching for the next retreat. And you'll never be on this one. So this is one of our problems with actually taking Vedana to be me, to be mine, to be a self. When the Buddha gave his second sermon to the group of five monks, the Dhammacakka Sutta made them all streamliners. Well, at least one of them anyway, and the other ones became streamliners sooner or later. But what made them all arahat, fully enlightened, was the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, where the Buddha said so beautifully, things like Vedana. So this Vedana, it doesn't belong to us. If it did belong to us, if it was ours, if we had power over it, we'd always say, Vedana, pleasure, pain, be this way, don't be another way. The very fact you can't control Vedana shows you, proves to you, it's not yours, it doesn't belong to you. If you can't control it, who does control it? Or rather, what does control Vedana? It's cause and effect nature, that's all. So all of your pleasure and pain, all of your happiness and misery, all of your inspiration and depression, it does not belong to you. It's part of nature, that's all. So let it go. No problem anymore. Disappointment is no problem. Elation is no problem. Even depression is no problem anymore. Pain is no problem. Disappointment is no problem. The great joys of jhana are no problem. Nothing is a problem. It doesn't belong to you. So why are you striving so hard to be happy? So after that we just stop. Stop striving to be happy. And what happens? Then we're happy. Well, you see the pain in that. This happiness and pain nothing to do with us. We give it up. We don't strive anymore. We let go. Abandon, renounce, free, content no matter what happens. Content to be in the most abject misery. Content to be in just great pain and disappointment. Just content. It's amazing when you can laugh at things like that. People think you're crazy. But you're wise. So this we don't attach to feeling. Sometimes people mistake the way we talk about jhanas. See, that's just going for bliss. You just want to bliss out, that's all. And said again and again, if you try to bliss out, you'll never be able to do it. If you crave for it, it'll never happen. This is all just a result of giving up wanting to be blissful. So letting the whole thing go, you don't even care. It's nothing to do with me. I can't control this, it's not my will. It comes according to causes. When it comes, it comes. When it goes, so what, big deal. Then it all comes easy, because letting go. Now we come to the real big insights. The real big insights of the knower, the citta. That's the third satipatthana. You should already have noticed that those satipatthana are only done, you've heard me say this before, vivicara kammehi. No, sorry, that's the wrong one. Vinaya loke abhita domanasa. Vinaya means having abandoned. Having got rid of, having abolished. Loke abhija is a synonym, it occurs many other places in the Pali Canon, for karma chanda, otherwise known as the first hindrance. Sometimes the five hindrances begin with Lokaya Bhita. Sometimes the second hindrance is called Domanasa, instead of the usual Vipada, the ill will. When I first was reading the suttas in Pali, I taught myself Pali, and then started reading them, these things started to stand out. Hang on, I've seen those words before somewhere. Hey, they're in the Satipatthana Sutta. Hey, this does not mean having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world. This actually means having abandoned the first two hindrances. And sure enough, when I looked into the commentaries, which were also in Pali, they hadn't been translated yet, but there it was too. That's what the commentaries, what our tradition has been saying for the last 1500 years. That phrase in the Satipatthana means having abandoned the two hindrances. The commentary actually says extension. By that means the first two in Pali means the whole five. The first two of any list is just the idiom to include the whole list. What we're saying there is these Satipatthanas are done having abandoned the five hindrances. Not before. If you want to become enlightened within 7 days or 7 years. That's why you can only understand the body when the five hindrances are gone. When you're that still, no restlessness, you're that fearless, no doubt, to that open, no craving or ill will, no desire or ill will, that clear, no sloth and torpor, you can finally see things. Or if you want to see them, but as they truly are. That's why you have to do this jhana practice to get rid of these five hindrances, so you can see these things so clearly. You see the jitta, that which knows. Many people have got many theories of what the jitta is. Whether the jitta survives nibbana, doesn't survive nibbana. Whether the jitta is God, or whether it's part of cosmic consciousness, or whether it's a ground of being, or what this thing which knows is, and what a waste of time even thinking about it, or even reading about it, or arguing about it. Because how many of you have actually seen the jitta, the mind? Again, that similarly a few days ago, the emperor, with five pieces of clothing on, which cover the emperor completely, the only way you can really know that emperor, who they truly are, take off all their five clothes. See the jitta. Or, that's my simile, the Buddha simile was like the person finding out the properties of gold. If you have gold, you have to get rid of all of the impurities, all the other trace metals, if you want to find out what gold truly is. If you want to find out what jitta is, what mind consciousness is, you have to get rid of all of the other impurities. In that particular sense, he meant sight consciousness, sound consciousness, nose consciousness, taste consciousness, and body consciousness, if you want to know what mind consciousness is. And that becomes a very powerful thing which you see in jhanas. Because in jhanas you've got, for the first time in your life, pure mind consciousness. Just the mind, the other five senses are completely gone. And afterwards, you recognize this thing we call consciousness, this thing we call knowing, is actually six different types of knowing. Absolutely six different, completely separate types of knowing. It's called in Bodhinyana Monastery, Ajahn Brahm's fruit salad analogy. Because it goes like this, you see that which we call experience, sensory experience, is like an apple arising. And then it completely disappears and is replaced by a coconut. And then a coconut absolutely vanishes and is replaced by a banana. And that absolutely vanishes and is replaced by another apple. And that absolutely vanishes and is replaced by a cauliflower. And that absolutely vanishes and is replaced by a mango. And that absolutely vanishes and is replaced by a coconut. In this simile, an apple is a simile for high consciousness. The apple of the eye. The nose is a simile for nose consciousness. Because some people's noses are like bananas. Cauliflower is for your ears. And what was the other one? Mangoes was for, I think, the body, because they taste nice. Oh, no, I don't know. I forget what the body was. But anyway, the coconut was for mind consciousness. So what actually happens you see that one consciousness arises and then completely ceases, absolutely vanishes, and a completely new, separate, original consciousness arises. It's always that whatever the five consciousness arises, it's always followed by the mind conscious. That's why when we see, or when we hear, or when we taste, when we feel, there's something which is similar to seeing, to hearing, to tasting, to smelling, to touching. Have you ever contemplated what's actually similar to these different senses? What's similar is actually the mind knowing what we see, the mind knowing what we hear, the mind knowing what we smell, taste, what we touch. The coconut comes up right after the apple, the mango, the banana, whatever. And that's what gives it the illusion of continuity and sameness. The result of the jhana is when you know what pure mind consciousness is, you can actually separate these moments of consciousness pretty easily. And actually see what happens. Sight, then mind. Maybe another sight, mind, sight, mind, sight, mind. Was it hearing mind, hearing then mind, hearing then mind, hearing then mind, feeling mind, feeling mind, feeling mind, sometimes feeling mind, 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 as you think. But that's how it works. And then you start to see that this consciousness, which you thought was a continuum, is not a continuum at all. Just in the same way you look at a stretch of sand on the beach, and you think that it's continuous. You go closer, and you find that it's granular. Imagine if that was not just granular, but it had six different types of grains there. It wasn't even the same type of sand there. But it looked the same from a distance, because you're not close enough up to it. You don't see it deeply enough. You look even closer and you find that there's gaps between the grains. The sand isn't even touching. The spaces between it. The spaces of complete emptiness. When one conscious moment is finished, the next conscious moment hasn't arrived. Hard to see that, but that's the way things are. Then it becomes quite clear to you that that which knows is subject to cessation. It's not continuous after all. It's got huge gaps. And one day that gap will be so big, you'll never give rise to another mango or coconut ever again. The cessation of consciousness, the cessation of mind, becomes not only possible, but inevitable. And why does that scare us? Because we think, I am that mango, I am that coconut, it's my coconut. Maybe my vibe. Leave it alone, Ajahn Brahm. Get your hands off it. I don't want this, I want to be, I want to be, I want to be. Sort of craving to be, craving for being. That's why it's scary. When you actually see it, it becomes so obvious. And then the incredible thing is that not only so obvious, but it's so lovely to not to be. You realise that what you're attaching to is just such a heap of suffering. Why do you want to be? That's really crazy. When you're being, it's always suffering. If you want to continue existing, it's always suffering, suffering, suffering. You never get what you want in this life. You always think the next life you will. We're making enough good karma in this life, the next life you'll be born in a nice heavenly mansion, or whatever, you know, heavenly mansion in this world, and I get everything I want, get a nice partner, have a loving relationship forever and ever, have beautiful children, always do what they're told, always become doctors and whatever else we want them to be. And everything will go really, really well. But of course, I mean, you know there's old age, sickness and death, that things go wrong. Next to the law of karma, Murphy's law is the most universal law in this whole universe, that things go wrong. If they can, they will, and they do. And Murphy's law. So, we understand that consciousness is not worth holding on to. Nothing in this world, in this universe, is worth holding on to, said the Buddha. Sabbang nalang abhi niwesanaya. All is not worth holding on to. Even the last vestige of consciousness of me. But we think it is, don't we? We think that maybe you can take all the rest of samsara, you know, Buddha, maybe take all this birth, death and sickness business. Maybe you can take our five senses, but leave me the mind. Leave me ultimate useful consciousness forever, never, never. Please, please, please. Sorry. Everything has to go. This is the final clearance sale. Everything has to go. This is true. And the last of the four satipatthanas is Dhamma, source of things, the doer, the house builder. This is what the Buddha said. House builder, you are seen. Your rafters are broken. You won't create any house for me anymore. Any abode where I can actually get an existence again. Any place where I can roost and grow. Where the mind can grow, where being can grow, where being can manifest and assert itself in this universe. It's all gone. It's a great thing we call the doer, the will. Which I love talking about, the will. Sometimes people say, well, if there's no will, why should I put forth any efforts? And the answer is obvious, because you've got no choice. It's an obvious answer. You have to put forth effort. If there was will, you could choose to be lazy, but unfortunately you can't. It's not up to you anymore. But you see, who actually does this? It's just a process doing it. I'm not saying, because sometimes people argue with me, they say, well, are you saying there's no such thing as no will? I'm not saying that. That will is. You can see it. You can experience it. My effort, choice, will happens. What I'm saying is there's no I behind it. It's just a process, that's all. So it's not you doing it. So stop worrying about it. Stop worrying about putting forth effort. Should I really try today? Is this the last day of the retreat? Should I really put forth extra effort? Stop worrying about it. If it comes, it comes. If it doesn't come, it doesn't come. Just get out of the way and let it happen. So, really understand what will and choice is. It becomes so easy. You know that simile I gave for the driverless bus. You want to get into control of your life. You want to get happiness. You come on this retreat because if I can learn about this retreat, then I can be happy ever after. I won't have to have all these pains. I can actually control my happiness and suffering by coming on the retreat. Then you come on the retreat and you want to find out where is the source of will. Where is the driver's seat? Who is actually driving you? Why is it that you can't get into vijaya? Where is that driver, the will? It's so stupid. Ajahn Brahm gives all these instructions, but why didn't the driver follow instructions? So you go up and you eventually, through meditation, through deep meditation, you find out the driver's seat inside you. The driver of your bus. Who you are, your will, your choice. Where all this comes from. And that's where you see the driver's seat is empty. There's no one there. There's no one driving you. There's no self, no soul, no being in there. Making all these choices, putting all these levers, making all these decisions. Oh, what a relief. It's a great relief to know you're not there. You've got no one to blame anymore. It's not my fault. No one in here. If I give a good talk, it's not my fault. It's Ajahn Chah's fault, sort of other teachers who trained me. It's their fault, nothing to do with me. It's true. It's all those conditions and causes you actually see, which are coming into fruition. So when you see there's a driverless bus there, what you do is you give up craving and ill will. What's the point of shouting at the bus driver? Come on, get yourself together. There's only one day to go. You've been waiting your time all this retreat. Only one day to go. Never know when you might get another retreat like this. You know, human birth is really precious. Meeting the Dharma is just so rare. Being on a retreat is incredibly rare. It's like winning the lotto in terms of Dharma, being able to come on a retreat. And now you're here. You say, come on, let's get it together, this last retreat. Shout out, please. Don't shout at the bus driver like that. You're just shouting at thin air. And that's why you get really tense and uptight. This last day of the retreat, just go back to your seat. Sit down and shut up. Stop complaining, stop controlling, stop all this doing business, stop craving, stop ill will, stop desiring, stop restlessness, stop sloth and torpor, stop all this doubt, you stop the five hindrances and everything happens. You have a wonderful journey when you stop shouting at the bus driver. It's amazing, the bus just does it itself. Yeah. That's right, yeah. So I don't mind. It's not my fault, I just play a magic chart. Just keep passing the back. But when there's no self, the back doesn't stop with you. So this is actually how insight arises. You really see into the heart of things, the word of another, and work of the mind which goes to the source of things. The two causes of screaming, insight. You need both there. You need the five hindrances overcome. When you have all those things happen, that's what the Buddha said, you're just knocking on the door of Nibbana. It's like you've got a big match, this heavy diamonds. You've got all the ingredients there, the words of another, all the Dharma you've heard, all the discussion you've had. You've got the gunpowder there. When you play with a match next to gunpowder, it's only a matter of time before something goes bang. That's what happens with insight. The big insight, so it just goes bang. You bliss out. Not through jhanas, but through insight. Something has been let go of. Something has been let off. Something has been destroyed. And usually you have to wait for a while before everything settles. When big insights happen, you don't know whether it's arahat, once returning, non-returning, or just stream winning, or actually nothing, maybe. Because the explosion is so great, it's like dust goes everywhere. You don't know what's happened, but you know something has. You have to wait, sometimes for days, months even. For a while, there's no defilements at all. For a while, there's no craving, no ill will. It's like being perfectly enlightened. Sometimes the force of those insights is so strong. There's no way any sensory desire, any ill will, anything can happen at all. You're just absolutely blissed out, free. You're experiencing what it's like to be an arahant. Then what happens is when the dust settles, you see what has been left standing, what has been destroyed. See what fetters are left, and what fetters are no longer there. What attachments have been destroyed once and for all. That's when you look around and then you see, oh, that was stream winning. That was wet return. That was non-return. That was arahat. This is what happens with those deep insights. It literally does blow your mind. Blow your mind into smithereens. You actually see what's left afterwards. The arising of insight is the most powerful experience a human being can have. Much stronger than jhanas. The jhanas are sometimes more blissful. But the insights are more powerful. When they happen, you know they've happened. But you have to wait a while until you see exactly what's left. You know what's going on. Even if you've only blown out the first few fetters in your stream winner, the other ones are so weak and the foundations are gone. They're just rocking until eventually they tumble as well. That's the way of insight. Powerful, beautiful, nothing to do with you. It's part of the process. But it's happened to men and women of all races and ages, all intelligences, for time immemorial, eon after eon after eon. It's all the same part of the process. When the seed is planted, it grows up, it becomes a flower, that's all. And when it becomes a flower, it always puts forth a few seeds. So other flowers come later on. When a person becomes enlightened, they always throw out their seeds of wisdom and compassion. So other people become enlightened afterwards. And so the whole process goes on and on and on. The process, not of birth, the process of extinction, ending, cessation. The most beautiful process in the whole world. That's what insight is. That's how it happens. And whether you like it or not, you're on the bus. Too late now, I'm sorry. Any questions about today's talk? Yes, why not, sir?
I'm not talking about insight, I'm talking about like that. Ordinary human beings like myself.
No, don't put yourself down. You're special.
And the memory that come up, like for example, when the mind feels like I listen to your talk and Sivajan talk and for many, many years, and then in the memory, when the mind feels like sometimes speaking, sometimes don't. Like this morning, for example, when the mind, see, we're not talking about inside of jhana or something like that. I just can't stop laughing at myself because I thought that I was during the last 7 days, 8 days, I pretend I think that I pretend that I don't want jhana. But actually, if I want jhana, then my mind was filled and thought that that's the desire that was that. That's what I really want. And then, and that comes from the memory that and then just laugh and thought that I was being really stupid. And then, but I did not see that the reason that I, and when I thought that, I just stop laughing at all that stuff, that was really. But then when you're talking, and then I saw that, yes, the reason that I did not reach jhana is because of the attachment. But how come the memory, sometimes, like, even though sometimes you are still mad, like sometimes you see things, and it arrives, and then you can see clearly, but sometimes you can't, you know, is that something to do with like that bun and gum?
Yeah, say like punya, which is like good karma or bad karma. It's good and gum. Actually, what happens is that when you get to a certain place in the universe, then that resonates with the instructions. If, for example, you go to a place, it resonates with the guidebooks you've read. And you start to recognize things. That's how memory works and how karma also works. So you get to certain stages of meditation, all of the instructions which you've read, which you may have forgotten about, which are still in there somewhere, then they come to the fore. And this is why those seeds of Dhamma are so important. You may forget everything which you've heard on this retreat, you think. It's all there, ready, for when the mind becomes still. Or when the mind goes into a jhana and comes out afterwards. And then the mind says, what do I do now? You've been programmed what to do now. You will go contemplating the four satipatthanas in the way I've just mentioned. That's the nature of things. That's the word of the other, you know, coming to the fore, coming to fruition. This is what happens sometimes. Why it is when we get to a certain stage of meditation, the mind turns this way rather than the other way. Because of all of our conditioning in the past. That's how will happens. That's how choice happens. That's why the mind moves. And especially because it's very rare that anyone else talks about these deep states of meditation. That I'm working with a clean slate. And so that what I say here has enormous power when you get into those deep states of meditation to really help you. Or any other Kupa Rajas have also talked about those states. Because when you get into those states, that's the only thing which will resonate with it. The mind goes into its inventory of, you know, what has it heard about this. And that's all you've heard. And that's why it will come to the fore. You may not recognize where it came from. You may not even be verbal, but the mind will move in those directions simply because of the program which I've been put in. That's why paratagosa, the words of another, are so important. Why they have to be, you know, the words of someone who's been there before. Make sense? Yeah.
Did I understand you to say that the five senses, five sense consciousness, rests on the mind consciousness, and the mind consciousness provides the continuity? In other words, the five senses seem to rest on mind consciousness.
And I would say the five senses, sense consciousnesses rest on mind consciousnesses, but it's like the mind consciousness holds their hand and is their inseparable friend. So it's like you've got this couple and you only see the husband with his wife. And the wife is always there. So you actually never really understand what that person is by themselves. To separate them, these inseparable couples, is so hard. And to separate the five senses from the mind is incredibly hard. This is what jhana does, it separates them off. You've just got the mind left. And then you recognise who's the wife, who's the husband is. Another example, you have, for those of you who've done a lot of reading, you have these words, kriti sukha. And different Translators have got different words for this word, piti sukha, like with the first jhana, that's the object of meditation. Some people call it joy and happiness, ecstasy and peace and bliss or whatever you call it. But the thing is that joy and happiness, piti sukha, are always together. So you can't separate them. That's why that these days that I just use them as a compound. I call them bliss, sometimes happiness, but it's just one and the same thing because they're conjoined. Except when you get into a third jhana. And that's when half of these Siamese twins of piti sukha falls away, the piti side, and then you're left with sukha, and then you know what sukha is, and then you know what piti is. If you haven't had a third jhana, you can't separate that pair. That's the only time when one of them falls away. In the same way, you can't really separate mind consciousness from the other senses until you've got at least into a first jhana. Because that's the time when the five senses fall away, and you're left with pure mind. Mind just alone, without any other consciousnesses. That's where you know pure gold.
So then the mind consciousness then is not the originator of feelings and perceptions?
It's not so much the originator, but it plays with it. It's just playthings.
So where do they arise from? Out of which part of the mind?
Out of that part of mind which seeks for birth. Which seeks for human existence to play around and experience with these five toys, thinking that it will make it happy. So consciousness uses these five senses as playthings.
So these
mind still, yeah.
So these feelings, perceptions are not particularly the function of any particular part of the mind.
These things are really the way the mind sees things according to its desires, especially like perceptions. Because you've got this whole heap of perceptions available to you. Sometimes they're given a symbol of a supermarket shelf. So when you go to get your muesli, there's so many different brands of muesli these days on the supermarket shelf. Why do you pick the same brand every time? Sometimes because of advertisements. Don't call your friends in. And the point is that we have, sometimes you don't even see the other brands, you don't even look at them to see what's in them. They may be cheaper, they may be better. But because of habit, you pick the old one again and again and again. That's your brand of music. And that's very similar to what the mind does. It always picks the same type of perceptions again. That's why we're creatures of habit. We all see the things in the same old ways. It's hard to see things anew, because it's habit. That's why mindfulness breaks habits. Sees things in a different way. It goes through different doors. That's why it allows perception to take wing. To see things, that you choose things from the supermarket shelf which you never chose before. Even weird stuff, like, you know, the carpet blowing up, or the, you know, the bricks melting, or just everyone disappearing into nothing. So these perceptions are on that shelf there, but we very rarely take them, because they're creatures of habit. That's what perception is, it's just what we want to pick up from that shelf. There might be some particular type of music we just really hate, because some bad experience in the past, and we just don't even see it. We deny its very existence. That's what perception is. So you've already mentioned what thought is and all these other aspects of the mind. But most of our thought is just like the echoes of the five senses. Sight, sound, smells, taste, touches, that's how we think. Very rarely do actually you think mind stuff, pure mind stuff. Because we haven't got much experience of pure mind. So when we separate these things out and allow the mind just to be by itself for a little while, we know what it is. Then we understand what actually the flow of consciousness truly is. And it's not the sameness all the time. It's granular. And it's different grains. It's not even the same type of sand from one moment to the next. Six different grains. Six different fruits. They're all fruits. They've all got something sort of similar, but they're completely different. One rises and the other one completely passed away. It's gone, finished with, done. Go on.
The contemplation of numbers, the fourth, the first sum, is that essentially the contemplation of mind objects? And is that essentially what we were talking about last night, where the mind goes out into the ashes of doing things?
Yeah, okay. It's interesting, at the monastery recently we've been discussing just the fourth Satipatthana. There's a few of the monks have been doing a bit of research. I remember seeing this first of all in Professor Ward's book on Buddhist India, where he was or India Buddhism I think it was called, where he was trying to find out the old question. This is about 30, 40 years ago he wrote this. What was original Buddhism? What was actually the original teachings of Buddhism? And he came to the conclusion, you can't say Theravada is the original Buddhism or Mahayana, because even the Theravada added a heap of stuff. So he wanted to find out what's the original. And being a professor, he tried to use, not what he wanted to find out, but use some means. He was an expert in the meter of the poems in Pali, so he could actually find out from the meter, as the meter changed, and also when the use of words changed, just actually try and find out what was the earliest strata of Buddhism as we know it. Obviously the Pali Canon actually contains most of the early stuff, but even the Pali Canon has added so much. And one of the things which he did find out by different recensions of the Satipatthana Sutta, that the fourth Satipatthana, the Dhammas, originally only had, as the two Dhammas for reflection, which was the five hindrances and the seven stages of enlightenment, the seven factors of enlightenment, the seven bhajangas, and all the other stuff which you read in the Satipatthana Sutta today. He suggested, and other monks have investigated this and say it's almost certainly true, have been added later on. The original Satipatthana Sutta, the fourth Satipatthana, was only the seven enlightenment factors and the five hindrances. So, as the last of the Satipatthanas. Fascinating, isn't it? But originally, the Dhammas, the sources of things, because all of these Satipatthanas, you see in the end there, the purpose of them, the function of them, and to actually to know a practice is good to know exactly what they're supposed to achieve, where they're supposed to lead to. It's very clear from those that they say that you do contemplation of the body for the purpose of knowing this is just the body, that's it. To see rising and falling, or rising and falling, both rising and falling. To see this is just the body, that's it. Nothing but the body. Not me, not mine, not a self. The whole purpose of doing the Satipatthanas is to see that none of these things are a self, a me or mine. Even the five hindrances, nothing to do with you, they're just part of nature. So don't get upset when the five hindrances are there. Or enlightenment, the enlightenment factors. Don't get upset. That's enlightenment. That's just happening. Nothing to do with you. Enlightenment is not self. It's not yours. No one is enlightened. Enlightenment is, but not the person. So this is just seeing. That was the original of the Satipatthana. See that there was just the... But I always like to call that the will, because the last Satipatthana, the Dhamma, the source of doing, creating all these things, the creator, that's the doer. And that's, again, you see, even like the God is supposed to be the creator. And as God, so the self. There's like a mirror image here between the illusion of a God and the illusion of a self. If you have a soul, you have to have an ultimate soul, or a ground of all souls, and that becomes like an ultimate being, a God. But the only truly atheistic religions will also be non-soul religions as well. See, both are just illusions and processes. When you have one, you have the other. It's a natural course. Because if there's nobody inside you, there's nobody in the being who occupies the place of God. It's just a process, the same. Just another type of five candles. That's amazing when you see there's nothing there at all. They say the progress of the world's religions went from pantheism to belief in many gods to the belief in monotheism, one God. And Buddha took it the last ultimate step. From pantheism of many gods to one God, from one God to no gods. The ending of everything. Emptiness. Finish. Gone. You can't go beyond nothing. Not the one, but the none. And you see this, what's the creator? Because that's supposed to be the role of a God, the creator. You can see just what's the creator inside you, this doer. Where does that come from? Conditions all rolling on, that's all. When you see this, then not only do you see there's no self, there's no ultimate being out there either. It's just processes rolling on. Beautiful, empty nothingness. Oh, what a relief. If you're a rational person and philosophize about it, that's the only obvious solution to the problem of existence of life. All other solution ends up in contradictions. If there was a creator God, then who created God? And who created the creator of God? And it just goes on and on and on. The only solution is nothing. So when you ask, go home and say, what do you get out of this retreat? Nothing, you know, so nothing. Okay, any question for Sue first?
So I have helped you to stop thinking about my feelings and my perceptions.
Oh, it's lovely, yeah.
Because in fact, it's obvious that they're very changeable.
Yeah.
So therefore, it has to be that they're dependent upon conditions.
Correct, yeah. So it's not my feelings, my... You don't worry so much about these things anymore. Yeah. Correct. So you can't hurt my feelings anymore. Isn't that wonderful? You call me, you can call me sort of anything you like. So,
so whatever happens really is only the result of the conditions.
Yeah.
And that really explains why sometimes things just work and other things just don't. Aren't there.
Right, so it's all up to you. You just sit back in the bus and just enjoy the ride.
So that's why when the Buddha sat down and decided to become enlightened, it worked because all the conditions were right.
Yeah.
And when you sat down and decided to become enlightened,
it didn't. Because I decided, that's why things don't work. So it's interesting, even the Buddha sort of sat under the Bodhi tree after years and years of frustration, years and years of trying, and then just let go. And this has happened to so many people, years and years of trying, years and years of struggling, immense effort, heaps of effort, working so hard. And one day, if it's either out of frustration or just out of wisdom, they just let go. You know that simile of how the donkey catches the carrot? You know, you may have been to Europe. In southern Europe, they have donkey carts, and the only way they make the donkey move is to tie a stick on the donkey's back and a string on the end of a stick with a carrot on the end. And donkeys being a bit stupid, so they see the carrot in front, so they move towards the carrot and they pull the cart, and the carrot also moves in front of it, so it's always trying to catch the carrot, which is just a little bit in front of it. You recognise that? Craving, life? Always trying to catch that carrot, the next relationship, the next job, the next retreat, jhana, it's just like this little carrot walking up. You never quite reach it. Suddenly you get very close. Then it just goes straight away. Now, the smart donkeys, you know this story, those of you heard it before, the really smart donkeys, these are the Buddhist donkeys, they've been to retreats before. They know what to do. They put immense effort. They really go for that carrot. They run as fast as they can. And when they're at absolute top speed, they stop. Absolutely stop. So you've been running so fast and now you stop. You don't do anything. Let go. And what happens as soon as you let go? The mind wanders all over the place. It's as if that carrot just goes further and further away from you. So what happens when you let go, first of all? And other people have tried that, haven't had any trust. I say, just let go. If mind wanders, let it wander. Have love. The door of my heart's open to you, mind. Whatever you want to do, sexual fantasies, sleep, snoring, whatever, go for it. Then you start snoring, sexy, fantasizing, dreaming. You say, oh, I can't do this. You've got no trust. The carrot goes further away from you, first of all. But if you're a smart donkey, you've got patience. You just continue to stop it. And you've got this incredible patience and courage. This carrot goes as far away as it's ever been in its life. You're just really going crazy. Then it stops and it starts coming towards you. You don't run towards it, you just stay there. And it soon it comes to where it was before, but it's swinging towards you now. And it swings right towards you, and all you need to do is open your mouth. And there's jhana session right in front of you. That's how donkeys catch carrots. So you know what to do, full effort, try your hardest, and then stop. And then have the patience. Everything goes wrong, it's all over the place, you think you're going crazy, the mind is all over the place. And then you're still, absolutely still, and the carrot starts coming towards you. You realise what letting go is, and what stopping is. And all you need to do is just, you don't need to move, just got it. Sometimes it takes years for that carrot to go up there and back again. But you stop. You have faith and trust in the Dhamma. Keep on stopping, letting go. Sometimes you think the meditation is getting nowhere. The carrot's way over there, further away than it's ever been before. You've had it close before, but it's never been that far away. Just got trust. Let go. Keep still. And it comes towards you. When it really starts coming towards you, when things start to happen, because you're letting go, you realize exactly what's happening. Only 7 lifetimes to go. 1 lifetime to go. This is it. You've got the carrot of Nibbana. That's my story. Our dog is cat carrots. By the stopping. Okay, this is a nice time for me to stop now, because there's no formal interviews this morning, so it's 9:30 now. But I'll be in the room now if anyone wants to come in. We'll leave a chair outside, so if you see the chair just outside in the corridor here, empty, you can go and sit in it and you'll be the next one in. If you see someone sitting in the chair, that means there's one person in front of you. Or you can sit outside, or you can camp outside, or you can beat each other up and go in first. Or you could do deals, I'll give you $10 if you give me your place. But it's also been the same thing this afternoon, from 3 till 5. So if anyone wants to run little interviews, please come in between now and 11 o'clock, and also between now and 5 o'clock. Please, if it's 10 to 11, please don't even have a hope of going in there. Because I'm going to finish off at 11 o'clock so we can all have lunch. I remember seeing this joke in the cartoons about this priest who was so busy that he had one of these answer machines fitted into his office, and it said, if you want a prayer, press number one, button one. If you want to see me personally, you haven't got a prayer, so go back to number one. Well, after 10 to 11, you haven't got a prayer. Okay. Oops.